Acts 2:14 through 2:36. The 14th talk in a series on the Book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 7, 1998 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
It's been a few weeks since we were in the Book of Acts. We're going to return to Acts chapter 2. Let me, just to remind you what we're looking at here, let me read this section that we're going to look at. I'll read a longer section. Part of this is review. The miracle at Pentecost has happened. The disciples are gathered, about 120 or so disciples are gathered in the upper room, just doing their normal thing, whatever that was for them at this time in their lives. And there's the sound of a mighty rushing wind that apparently is heard all over the city and attracts people from every quarter of the city, Luke says, who come to observe what's going on. There's the sound of a powerful rushing wind. There are flames of fire dancing over their heads, and they begin to prophesy, or how's he put it, to speak of the mighty deeds of God in languages that they don't naturally know, languages that are known by the observers, by the crowd that's observing them, but are not known by the speakers. And one by one, they say things in languages that are recognized by the crowd, by someone in the crowd. So this is this miracle that's happening, and they respond in one of three ways. Some of them perhaps believed, but others just remain kind of agnostic and perplexed. Wow, what's going on here? And others just simply rationalize the whole thing. They're just drunk. And Peter stands up and he responds to the unbelief of the people in the crowd. Peter taking his stand, this is verse 14, chapter 2. But Peter taking his stand with the 11 raised his voice and declared to them, "Men of Judea and all you who live in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and give heed to my words. For these men are not drunk as you suppose, for it is only the third hour of the day. But this is what was spoken of through the prophet Joel." And then he quotes Joel. "And it shall be in the last days, God says, that I will pour forth of my spirit upon all mankind, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Even upon my bondslaves, both men and women, I will in those days pour forth of my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will grant wonders in the sky above and signs on the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and glorious day of the Lord shall come. And it shall be that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." Now Peter goes on. "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs, which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. This man, delivered up by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. And God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power. For David says of him," and now he quotes Psalm 16, "I was always beholding the Lord in my presence, for he is at my right hand, that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue exulted. Moreover, my flesh will also abide in hope, because thou wilt not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow thy Holy One to undergo decay. Thou hast made known to me the ways of life. Thou wilt make me full of gladness with thy presence. Brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. And so, because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him with an oath to seat one of his descendants upon his throne, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Christ, that he was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. this Jesus God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses. Therefore, having been exalted to the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured forth this which you both see and hear. For it was not David who ascended into heaven, but he himself says, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make thine enemies a footstool for thy feet." Therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. Okay, there's two chunks here. One of them we looked at the last time we were together in Acts, in the book of Joel, and I just want to review that briefly. As I mentioned 3 weeks ago, Joel, as best I understand the prophecy of Joel, Joel is prophesying an event that has yet to occur in the world. As we sit here nearing 2000 AD, it has not yet ever occurred. It's something that still remains in our future. So when he says, "And it shall be in the last days," in verse 17, that means last days in a more absolute kind of sense, very much toward the end of the world, the universe, the earth as we know it. At that time, Joel seems to describe a couple of events, one where either a swarm of locusts or an army that's being described metaphorically as a swarm of locusts, it's kind of difficult to tell, is invading Israel and has the potential for devastating the land, completely devastating the land. Joel describes the devastation that's in store for them, but then Joel goes on to describe that in fact what is going to happen is the land will be spared. And why will the land be spared? Because the people repent. Then he goes on to describe a further spiritual rejuvenation of Israel. And it's in that context that this part that he's quoting gets quoted. And that seems to be accompanied by another really dramatic event as well. This one does seem to be an invading army of people gathered together, Gentiles from all over the world gathered together to come into Israel and destroy the nation. And it's in as they are gathering and as they are beginning to march on Israel, which is accompanied at the same time by dramatic astrological events, or at least astronomical events. Something big is happening in the world. The sun is darkened, the moon is darkened. It's a global, some sort of global catastrophe is transpiring at the same time that this army is coming on Israel. In that context, this happens that Peter quotes. "I will pour forth my spirit upon all," this says all mankind, this translation, but as you remember, it just says all flesh, and I think he means all of Israel in this case. "Upon all of Israel, your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Even upon my bondslaves, both men and women, I will in those days pour forth of my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will grant wonders in the sky above and signs on the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and glorious day of the Lord shall come. And it shall be that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." Notice that the part that he quotes, he's preoccupied with every man, woman, and child, slave and free, every class of society, everyone in the nation is going to what he calls prophesy. And Peter is connecting that with the event that is transpiring right here on the day of Pentecost in the first century. What's the connection? The connection, Peter says, is, you know what Joel prophesied about how the Spirit of God is going to come and is going to make everybody in Israel, in a sense, a prophet? That's what's happening right now before your very eyes on a smaller scale. It's only 120 people that it's happening to before your eyes. The day is going to come when it's going to happen to the entire nation. But it's the same spirit being poured out to accomplish the same effect. Now, what does he mean by prophesy? As I tried to explain last time, it doesn't mean he's making people into Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. it means that he's turning them into people who know what God is up to and could therefore speak forth to anyone who's interested, could explain to them the purposes of God, could explain to them why we are here, what this is all about, what's transpiring, what's going on, what the meaning of God's activity in the world is. And that's what's happening on the day of Pentecost. I suggested that they've been groping towards some kind of understanding of who this Jesus was and what role did he play and how did he fit into the thing. They've been studying the scriptures and trying to understand. And then suddenly on the day of Pentecost, the Spirit of God is poured out and they begin speaking from, I would imagine, from Old Testament passages, but just in generally explaining to one another how this all fits together. Don't you see? Jesus is the one that Isaiah was talking about when he said this. And Jesus is the one that Jeremiah was talking about when he said this. And this is what Deuteronomy such and such is talking about. And all of a sudden is falling together. It's clicking. They get it. They're understanding the gospel. Now, at the time, it was just incredibly remarkable. You and I are in a position to understand just as well as these people did on this day what God is up to. Through our study of the Old Testament scriptures in the light of the New Testament, as the apostles have guided us and helped us to understand the gospel story, you and I, without much effort even, just kind of hanging around a little bit, know as much about the gospel as they are discovering on this day of discovery. And as I said a long time ago, I think that's what Jesus meant when he said, "He who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than John the Baptist, who's the greatest born of woman." That we have this incredible advantage of being at a time in history where the story has been finished, the story has been told, and we now are in a position to understand it. That's why Peter takes this passage. And I think it's important to get perspective on Peter's own comment about what's going on here. At least in this day and age, it's important. Peter's really not all that interested in the different languages. He's really not all that interested in the flames of fire over the head or the roaring wind. The thing that is most noteworthy to Peter is we get it. We understand. We comprehend. Now we know what God is up to in the world. In other words, it's the fact that all 120 of these people are prophesying, are speaking forth the message of God and the purposes of God. That is the most noteworthy and significant thing that's happening on Pentecost as far as he's concerned. And that he quotes a passage that he says corresponds to that. With this incredible emphasis in the charismatic movement in the church today on dramatic displays of the power of God, both counterfeit and real. With all this emphasis upon that, we are giving a very eccentric interpretation to this passage. Pentecost, the message of Pentecost is not go out and really try to find out how you can get flames of fire dancing over your head, or how you can laugh like hyenas, or whatever it is that you do. I mean, that is surely not what is at all interesting to Peter. What's interesting is, go out and be filled by the Spirit in order that you can understand, in order that you can know the things of God and can declare them to other people. That's clearly and unmistakably Peter's emphasis here. Now, just parenthetically, I do, for those of you who remember, David Carlyle asked, when we were talking about Joel, there's a passage in there, and God says, "I will restore all the years that the locusts have eaten." And I confessed to David that I was bothered by that passage because by my interpretation, it looks like these are very short-term events. We're not talking about years and years and years of devastation of Israel. We're talking about a matter of days that are transpiring. And so I couldn't quite figure out why does he say we'll restore all the years that the locusts have eaten. As we're leaving, Jody suggested an interpretation that makes a lot of sense to me, and that is the devastation by the locusts may have only taken a few days, but it took years to grow the trees and the vines and the orchards and whatever that are have been eaten in a matter of days, that is left to the natural course of things, in order to restore the land to the place that it had been before the locusts came. You're talking about years of work by nature that needs to restore it. That has to be what Joel meant. That makes a lot of sense. Now we get to verse 22, where Peter actually begins a kind of sermon. What it is actually is an argument. And the punchline, or the conclusion of this argument, is in verse 36. And I think we need to keep that in view, or we're not going to understand what he's doing here. Therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him, that is Jesus, both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. That's the argument, and he's going to build an argument to make the case. I'm suggesting to you, men of Israel, in front of me here today, that in view of the events in the past few days, there can be absolutely no question but what this Jesus of Nazareth that you crucified is the Messiah, the Mashiach, the Anointed One. And what does that mean? It means the one who is the son of David, the one in the line of David, whom God has appointed to rule over his kingdom for all eternity. That's the Anointed One with a capital A. And we can know for sure, given the events of the past few days, that Jesus was that Anointed One, that Christ. That's where he's aiming. That's where he wants to go. I'm going to shift gears here in midstream. Maybe I'll come back to a couple of things in verses 22, 23, and 24, but just for the sake of making the argument, let's look at the heart of his argument in 25 and following. He says, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs, which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. This man, delivered up by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power." So he ends that part by saying it was impossible for him to be held in its power. And now he goes on to quote Psalm 16, I think, in order to tell us what he means, explain what he means by it was impossible for it to hold him in his power. Then he quotes Psalm 16, and I won't read that now. We've read that before. If we go to Psalm 16, let me suggest what I think is going on there. The problem that Peter's dealing with is that Psalm 16, being poetry, is how should I put it? Without being prejudicial here, is at best difficult to understand. It's a bit cryptic. And he understands that there are different ways that you could take it. There are different ways that you can understand what it is that David is saying and what it is that he's doing. So Peter's going to make the argument that there's one interpretation that you can give to Psalm 16 that makes a whole lot of sense in view of what we've just seen with our very own eyes. And in effect, he's saying, I'm betting that that's what Psalm 16 was talking about. Now, what do we find when we go to Psalm 16? Maybe we should turn there. There's all kinds of questions I have about how to interpret Psalm 16. I'm just barely getting a kind of shadowy understanding of what I think is going on here, so I won't be able to answer a lot of specific questions, but let me just try to orient you to what I think is going on. Preserve me, O God, for I take refuge in Thee. I said to the Lord, Thou art my Lord. I have no good besides Thee. As for the saints who are in the earth, they are the majestic ones in whom is all my delight. The sorrows of those who have bartered for another god will be multiplied. I shall not pour out their drink offerings of blood, nor shall I take their names upon my lips. The Lord is the portion of my inheritance and my cup. Thou dost support my lot. The lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Indeed, my heritage is beautiful to me. Fundamentally, I think what he's doing is he's saying, my life is about what you want my life to be about, Lord. It's not about what all these idolaters are seeking. Their idolatry is not interesting to me. I don't want to go there. I don't want to be what they are. I don't want to think the way they think. I don't want to pursue what they're pursuing. Rather, I want to pursue my relationship with you. You are my only good. There is no good besides you. You are my portion, the portion of my inheritance. You are my cup. You support my lot. Indeed, my heritage is beautiful to me. Now, in a way, any of us ought to be able to say similar sorts of things. But I think by the time we're done with the psalm, it becomes apparent to me that this is something that only David can say. You and I couldn't say this and mean exactly what David means. Because when he talks about his inheritance and his cup and his lot and his heritage and the lions that have fallen to him in pleasant places, I'm inclined to think that he has in mind the covenant that God came and made with David back in 2 Samuel. That David is one of a handful of unique people in the history of mankind, where God has chosen David to be the head of a dynasty, of a people, of a line of people that are going to rule for God, are going to be the sons of God. That is, they are going to be the human manifestation of the authority of God himself on earth. That was what was promised to David and his line. Somewhere along the line, and I'm in fact inclined to think that it's here in Psalm 16, David comes to realize once and for all that what God has in mind is not that his dynasty will live forever and ever and ever, will go on forever and ever and ever, but that literally there's going to be a child in the line of David who personally is going to reign forever and ever and ever and ever. The promise that was initially made to David could be construed to mean there's going to be one son of David after another son of David after another son of David for all time. And never is that dynasty going to be overthrown and some other family is going to gain the reins. You could construe it that way. But here in Psalm 16, I think through a dream, David comes to, it is revealed to David that there is going to be one individual who will be immortal and in his immortality will sit in the throne of David and personally rule forever and ever. Well, that's what he means by his heritage and his lot and his portion and so on, is that David has been chosen to be the progenitor of that anointed one. And David is meditating on this gracious gift, this gracious role that God has given him to play, and is just kind of dumbfounded by it. That's what I want, God. I want to be a person who submits to your will. I don't want to worship these other gods. You and what you have promised me, that's what I'm interested in. Now in 7 to the end, he seems to describe, I think, a revelation that has come to him in a dream. I think that's how I would take, I will bless the Lord who has counseled me. Indeed, my mind instructs me in the night. The fact that it's instructing him in the night suggests to me that it's a dream, and counseled could be translated instructed, especially the Greek term. The Lord has come and has taught him something, and it apparently has come to him in the night. Now I think he's describing an aspect of the dream, whatever occurred to him. I have set the Lord continually before me. I'm not sure that's the best translation, but the idea is the Lord is continually before him. Because he is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. Therefore my heart is glad, and my glory, or the Greek has my tongue, rejoices. My flesh also will dwell securely, for thou wilt not abandon my soul to Sheol, neither wilt thou allow thy Holy One to see the pit. Thou wilt make known to me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. In thy right hand there are pleasures forever. Here's the ambiguity in the psalm. When he talks about my flesh will dwell securely, who is his flesh? What does he mean? Does he mean I, David, will dwell securely? My soul, you will not abandon Sheol. You're not going to let me die. You will not allow thy Holy One. Is that me, David? You won't allow me, David, to see the pit. If we just take the psalm in isolation, it's not an impossible interpretation. Could the dream that David received be that God had come and revealed to him that he, David, would not die, that he would not see destruction, he would not go to Hades, that God would make known to him the paths of life and grant him an inheritance in life? Could be. And there's nothing about the psalm in isolation that can decide against that once and for all. But there is another interpretation that we can give to the psalm. My flesh, and what's confusing is that in English this doesn't carry across, and that's what this will seem a little strained to you, I would expect. But the reason it seems strained to you, because in English we don't do this. We would never say, my flesh also will dwell securely, and mean my line, my physical descendants. But in both Greek and Hebrew, that's entirely possible. That is not it's not an unconventional way of describing that. So to say my flesh also will dwell securely could mean my physical descendants can dwell secure. Actually, the Greek has will abide in hope. I think that's how in Acts it has it. My flesh will abide in hope. So he's saying my line from here on out can be secure in this hope. What hope? That God is going to keep his promise that he's made when he made this covenant with me. We can know that this is going to happen. And how is it that we know it's going to happen? How is it that it's going to be fulfilled? You will not abandon my soul to Sheol. What's my soul? Again, in English, that has to be David. But I'm not so sure that that's the case in Hebrew or Greek. There is a soul from me. Let me put it this way. Thou wilt not abandon the seed that will come from me to Sheol. I think we could paraphrase it that way and recognize that that's another possible interpretation to what he's saying. You will not abandon that descendant who will come from me to Sheol. Neither will you allow that Holy One to see the pit. So the controversy with respect to how to take Psalm 16 comes down to how do you take those three words, my flesh, my soul, the Holy One, what's the reference of those phrases? The person David or some other individual? Clearly in the line of David it would have to be, but some other individual in the line of David for whom it's literally going to be the case that God will not abandon them to Sheol, nor will he let them see corruption. Well, that's the controversy that Peter is addressing, I think, in Acts 2, in his message. And what he's trying to argue is the events of the past couple of days have pretty much decisively answered how we should interpret Psalm 16, haven't they? And he goes on to put it this way. After quoting that in Psalm 16, he says, "Brethren, I may constantly say to you regarding the patriarch David, that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day." If you were to take a trip to Israel, they would point out the tomb of David to you, at least the traditional tomb of David, and the archaeologists believe that there's some merit to that. His tomb is with us, was with them to that day, and his tomb is with us to this day. Peter's maybe even pointing in the direction of the tomb, saying, look, his tomb is right over there. If Psalm 16 was making the claim that David would never see corruption, then we're in a heap of trouble. Because God lied. God got it wrong. God made a mistake then. But Psalm 16 doesn't have to mean that it's David that will not see the grave. There's another way of taking it. So Peter argues for the other interpretation. So, because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him with an oath to seat one of his descendants upon his throne, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of this anointed one, that he was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. So he says there's another interpretation. David was speaking prophetically about a descendant of his that would be the anointed one with a capital A. This Jesus God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses. And he says, isn't it this Jesus, when he was among us, kept telling us that he was the Son? He described himself as the Son. He claimed to be sent by God to establish the kingdom of God. I mean, he was pretty clear who he claimed to, who he claimed his identity was. And lo and behold, now we sit here a few days later, and here's a man, the only man in my awareness, who was not abandoned to the grave, who did not decay in the grave, who was not vanquished by death. It sure sounds to me like that's a fulfillment of this prophetic prediction that was embedded in the prophecy of Psalm 16, Peter is saying. Therefore, having been exalted to the right hand of God and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured forth this which you both see and hear. And then he refers to Jesus' promise that he would, that the Father had promised him this gift of the Spirit to be given out into the world. And he says, now that Jesus was raised and been exalted to the right hand of the Father, he's received that promise that he said he was going to get, the Spirit of God, and he's poured it out on mankind just as he said he would. Or he's poured it forth just as he said it would. It wasn't David who ascended into heaven, but he himself says, now he quotes another psalm, what is it? 110, where it's a famous psalm where David is writing and says, the Lord Yahweh said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make thine enemies a footstool for thy feet. Jesus quotes that psalm when he says, who is David talking about? Because who could be greater than David? If David is the head of the dynasty, how could anyone later in the dynasty be greater than David? And yet, nonetheless, Jesus says, there's this person in Psalm 10 that David is not ashamed to call his Lord. So, and David just asked, Jesus asked the Pharisees, well, who do you think he was talking about? And what the significance of that psalm is that David himself recognizes that there's one coming in his line who is greater than he. One to whom he would bow his knee as Lord. So Peter quotes that and says, so it wasn't David who ascended into heaven. David acknowledged that there was someone greater coming, someone that he was willing to call his Lord. That's the one who ascended into heaven. Therefore, he ends it, therefore let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. Okay, let me pause there for your questions or comments or discussion. If we have time, I'll go back to 22 and 23. But
The question being often, the term all flesh, which is translated all mankind, in the Joel passage,
yeah.
Why is it Israel?
If we look at it in the context of Joel, that's what he's talking about, is that Israel has been kind of gathered together, surrounded by their enemies, impending disaster, and it's upon them. In fact, Joel, I think it even says specifically in a part that is not quoted here in Acts, I think he even talks about, in Joel 2, if you start back in verse 27, thus you will know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and there is no other, and my people will never be put to shame. And it will come about after this that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and daughters will prophesy, your old men will dream dreams, and so on. The you, the second person there, your sons and daughters, I think is a reference back to Israel. In the part following what he quotes, and it will come about that whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be delivered, for on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there will be those who escape, as the Lord has said, even among the survivors whom the Lord calls. That the survivors that he's talking about are those people who have been sanctified in this final sanctifying event of Israel, where they are gathered at Mount Zion in Jerusalem. The thing that's always bothered me about that Joel passage is that, you know, several times have I read Acts 2, but never have I really looked at Joel and tried to sort out what's going on in Joel. I used to make all kinds of claims, and it shall be in these last days. Oh, isn't it interesting? From Peter's perspective, the last days started at Pentecost, because he's calling them the last days. well, now I realize how mistaken that was. No, he's calling the last days the last days. Joel hasn't even happened yet. And it always bothered me. I will grant wonders in the sky above and signs on the earth beneath. Blood, fire, vapor of smoke, sun shall be turned to black, darkness and the moon into blood. And I went, there's no record of that on the day of Pentecost in the first century. But if he's going to quote a passage and say, this is that, why don't we have a record of the sun doing weird things and the moon doing weird things and all this darkness over the land? No clue, no hint that anything like that is going on. And yet, you know, Peter unabashedly quotes Joel as saying, right, accompanying this event will be these astronomical, astrological events, this global disaster of some kind. Well, there's no problem if what he's quoting is not the event of the day of Pentecost, but some future event where this will literally come true. There really will be these signs in heaven. But what's interesting to him is not the signs in the heaven. What's interesting to him is that the Spirit being poured out on Israel in that day is the same thing happening that's happening to this handful of people in the upper room.
I'm still confused about that aspect of him saying this is happening now, but it's not happening now. I was wondering if you could more basically.
Well, okay. Let me get at it this way. What he's noting is that people who didn't have a clue, all of a sudden, it's clicking, and they understand who this Jesus is, what role he's playing, what his significance is, what God is doing to save the world, the nature of the salvation he's offering the world, and so on. All of a sudden, the pieces are coming into place. You know, all this mush of prophetic predictions that they have learned since their childhood, all of a sudden it's cohering into a unified picture of what God wants to do in the world and what he wants to do in our lives. They didn't understand that before. And what is that attributable to? Because the Spirit of truth has been poured out upon them. Well, the Jews today are still in a jumble. They have, if they know their Bibles at all, and most of them don't even know their Bibles, at least American Jews don't even know their Bibles anymore. But if they know their Bibles at all, it's just kind of a jumble of predictions and promises. They don't really have any clear picture of what God has told them he's up to. But Joel is predicting a day when the same thing is going to happen in Israel that happened to these people in the upper room, the Spirit of truth is going to be poured out upon them, and all of a sudden it's all going to congeal, it's going to click, and they're going to go, oh, I see. You mean that Jesus we crucified, he was the Messiah sent from God to be the high priest and the propitiation for the sins of the world, and on and on and on. And what God is really after is to grant us life in his kingdom eternally. Notice Psalm 16. It's cryptic, but he says, you will make known to me the ways of life, and I will be filled with joy in thy presence forever. Something like that. It seems to me even there that the way I would understand what David is saying is, what's the import of there being one of my descendants die, not see death, not be conquered by death? The import to me is, I'm going to have a place continually in the presence of God in life. I'm because he's not going to be abandoned to the grave, I am not going to be abandoned to the grave either. I think that's, it's not real clear, but I think that's the connection that he's intending there in Psalm 16. Sorry, I got sidetracked. So my main point in answer to your question is, what Peter thinks is identical about what's happening before him and what's going to happen in the future that Joel is referring to is the Spirit of truth being poured out, enlightening people's minds in order that they might know what we call the gospel, the good news, that they might understand what it is that God is doing in the world.
That's helpful. I think that I get that piece as far as what he sees as the significance of the an evidence of the outpouring of the Spirit is understanding. What confuses me is there a place in the text that he clearly defines, or is it just from what you understand to be how the Jews experience would interpret it and our experience? Is there a place in the text where he says, this is happening partially now and it will happen more fully later? Or would they have thought, you know, why would they have not thought this is the beginning of the last day? Maybe not all the things are happening now, but this is the beginning because this is happening, what it says here.
Well, okay. I think there's a place in the text, but in order to, I need to explain something. In verse 16, he says, this is what was spoken through the prophet Joel. The problem is, this is what was spoken through the prophet Joel is somewhat ambiguous. What's the this, Peter, and in what sense is this what was spoken through the prophet Joel? Let me see if I can... I'm trying to concoct this off the top of my head. This will not be very good, but I think you can get the point of it. If someone were to point to the shooting at Thurston and say, this is what happened at Jonesboro, in what sense of this do they mean this is what happened at Jonesboro? If somebody had predicted Jonesboro in a literal prophecy of some kind, could someone still come along and look at the prophecy predicting Jonesboro and say, oh, well, this is what happened at Thurston? Or let's say somebody now predicted another student shooting other students in a high school somewhere, and we saw that prophecy, that prediction, and we said, oh, well, this is just what just happened at Thurston. I don't think we have any problem using our language that way, because what we don't mean that the prediction was a prediction of this, but what we mean is what the prediction, the event that the prediction is predicting, that's the same kind of event in certain significant ways as the event that this prediction is predicting. That's the sense in which I'm taking it.
And that combined with your experience is what makes you convinced that that's part of what he's doing.
Primarily combined with my understanding of what's going on in Joel, that it seems unmistakable to me in Joel that we're not talking about an event that in any way resembles first century AD. It's just there's nothing that Joel is talking about that transpired in the first century AD. And therefore, and particularly when you add to it, I mean, several times in Joel, several times, he mentions these global disasters going on, or that with the sun, the stars, and the moon, and everything. Nothing like that, I think, has happened in the whole history of the world. It remains in our future. Whether it's going to be nuclear holocaust or asteroids or some kind of astronomical disaster, that something's going to happen in the Earth that's going to completely disrupt the atmosphere in a significant, dramatic kind of way. And that's going to be a sign that we're at the time that these events are talking about. And that's what Joel seems to be talking about. And I think unmistakably. I mean, I think clearly. So, now, in fairness to other interpreters, there is a way of dealing with prophecy where they would take Joel, and this is what I used to do. I looked at Joel here, and it shall be in the last days, God says, that I will pour forth my spirit upon all mankind, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, so on, and I will grant wonders in the sky, so on in verse 19. And there's a way of interpreting prophecy where people talk about, Bible scholars talk about, you need to understand the prophetic perspective. And what they go on to describe is, the prophet is looking down through the tunnel of time as if you were up on one of the peaks of the Cascades, looking down the Cascade Range. So you're on the North Sister looking north, and as you look up the range, you see Jefferson and Hood and Adams and St. Helens and so on. That from the perspective of the prophet, you simply note those high points in the timeline. And so you just kind of talk your way down the tunnel. And that's what Joel is doing. he's looking into the future and he sees the day of Pentecost, and that's what he's describing, I will pour forth my spirit upon all mankind and so on. And then beyond that, the next thing he sees is grant wonders in the sky above, signs of the earth beneath, blood, fire, vapor, smoke, and so on. And that'll be before the great and glorious day of the Lord. In looking at it that way, you can solve the problem of, well, how come we don't have the signs and wonders in the sky on the day of Pentecost? Well, because that didn't apply, because that was a future event. That part of what Joel is saying was in the future, but the part about the pouring forth the Spirit, that's happening now, Peter's saying. I have two problems with that, three problems with that, but I'll forget one of them, so I only have two. My first problem with that is it seems like an invention. It seems like there's really no reason to think that that's what's happening in biblical prophecies, particularly not in a place like Joel, except that it helps solve problems that we have created for ourselves in Acts 2. And that if we didn't have the problems in Acts 2, we'd never go back to Joel and say, well, you see what's happening here is he's telescoping in on a future event beyond the present event. It's very ad hoc. I'm just inventing this thing to help me solve my problem. That's my first problem with it. Second related issue is, when I go to Joel itself, it sure presents itself as describing a single event, a single scene. And in describing that single scene, all these pieces are intended by Joel to be seen as working together. I mean, I'm really artificially tearing Joel apart if I go back to Joel and say, well, you know, that part of this is happening at this time and part of this happening at this time and so on. That perspective on prophetic literature doesn't really deal with the prophetic literature as literature, you know, as a kind of a coherent piece of communication. And my third problem is, if Peter thought that's how you interpret Joel, then it would be very easy for him to just stop quoting right after verse 18 in chapter 2 and leave the part that is not at all relevant to what he's saying here, to leave that off. You know, why quote it at all? Now, you could say the same thing to my interpretation. Well, doesn't that apply to your interpretation as well? Yes, except that I think what he wants is the last line. And it shall be that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. He doesn't really need for his purposes anything about granting wonders in the sky or so forth, but they're just the few, that part of the prediction that intervenes between the part about the Spirit and the part about everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. He doesn't want to scuttle the last one, so he just reads right on through and until that point. But I don't think that means that the part about the wonders in the sky is at all relevant to the point that he's making here in Pentecost. But before and after that, both are relevant. And that's the part that he wants to preserve. That perspective on prophetic literature is very prevalent. I mean, that's what I was trained in. And I just don't think it gets us anywhere. I think it comes from not understanding what's going on in the New Testament to start with. And that's very unfortunate. Is that a hand, Logan? The light's there.
When you talk about David in Psalm 16 saying, I shall not see thee, Psalm 1, and you said that you could interpret it as my flesh to mean my mind, my family. I kind of hesitate to do this. Is it possible that he's just speaking in character? That he's, even as you stand there and say, I, David, and we know you're not David, he's saying, I, the Holy One, even though we know David's not the Holy One, now we know David's not the Holy One. Is it possible that in their prophetic utterances they are standing in character for the person, and so it's not so much the vocabulary they use as it is their position and perspective when they speak? I would find that easier to understand, at least with my voting points, than hearing the maiden fleshing of my line, my family.
Yeah, I think that's possible. We do have to keep in mind we're dealing with poetry, and I'm at a tremendous disadvantage in that regard. I mean, I don't understand poetry. But we are dealing with poetry, so whatever is possible and whatever is plausible in the context of poetry, I think, is is a valid or a legitimate interpretation. So I won't say no, but I'd have to work with that to get comfortable with exactly how that's working there. But.
Yeah.
It raises the question, you know, we have all these channelers and we faith phones, I guess not the channelers. But whenever someone does something like that in the Old Testament, if they are speaking in character for the Christ to come, how did he get there?
Right.
You know, it's like, was he overcome? It gets kind of weird at that point.
Right. That wouldn't be the way in which I would agree with it. If he's doing it, he's only doing it as a poetic device, not as some kind of phenomenon. I do think he's received special revelation. I mean, I think there's supernatural revelation that lies behind the content of what he's saying, but in his communication of it, he's just making poetry. One more, and then we'll still have that.
I like the view that says prophesying is simply rationally explaining a new understanding. I think I've been working from a different model when I look back at 1 Samuel when Saul sent his servants to capture David, and at some point they would walk away prophesying until finally Saul himself went and ended up prophesying and getting naked, and it has always seemed really strange to me that the Spirit of God would influence somebody in such an unrational way. And I thought that was being carried forward into the New Testament in Acts. And I like what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I don't know what to do with those passages that do seem to involve some kind of out of control sorts of experiences. But I don't think that's, but as you say, I'm pretty convinced that's not what we're talking about here in Acts in any case, if it ever occurred. And even if it did occur, and even if it did it like Saul, even if God, what's he called? He calls it a spirit? Sent upon him a spirit of something or other.
Yeah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also, so that he went along prophesying continually.
We have to be careful when we look at that kind of thing. God not only enlightens, but God deludes. Another point where he talks about sending a deluding spirit, I don't remember now where. I think that's on Saul as well, but in a different context maybe. But God can send a deluding spirit as well. So he can send a spirit of irrationality, a spirit of out of control, a spirit of, for his purposes, he does a lot of different things in our lives and in the lives of other people. And we mustn't just paint everything the same brush and assume that just because God is sending a spirit, that it is the spirit of truth that we're talking about. Not necessarily. But that is what we're talking about here in Acts. We're talking about the promised coming of the Spirit of Truth, who brought to their remembrance all that Jesus said and gave them understanding and enlightenment. Okay, one last question.
This is really kind of a tangent, so I don't want to deal with it now. That's great. I believe there actually was another human being who didn't die. Wasn't there one of the prophets, I think Enoch or somebody, who was
there? Yeah,
I was just wondering what the significance of why did God do that? It seems to me that there's a connection between holiness and being allowed to retain that is being made in the psalm. That it's kind of interesting the way that it's phrased, because it says something about the agony of death was ended when he was resurrected. It's not the agony of death was ended when he expired and was not feeling pain anymore. But the agony of death is not so much the physical pain of being nailed to the cross, which of course is extremely painful, but just being dead is an agony for a being that continues to be alive. And that death is just an utterly inappropriate thing for someone who is inherently filled with life, as the word right being is. So I was just wondering, it occurred to me if that is the case, that the psalmist is saying that it would be impossible for death to have any control over him because it's illogical for a being who's inherently filled with life to be dead, If this was God's statement about the prophets, I mean, since they're dead, they must have been, had been sinners also. Maybe they were just, you know, if you, on a continuum of good and evil, they were much closer to the good end than most people are.
He goes on to quote the psalm to prove that it was impossible for him to be held in its power. I don't think he's speaking metaphysically. That is, I don't think he's saying something like Jesus was just so pure and so holy that, you know, death couldn't hold him. Rather, he's saying it was so clearly a part of God's purposes to not have him be vanquished by death that there's no way that God was going to allow it to happen. So it has more to do with the purposes of God than metaphysics, I think. So because that's the case, then we take the same thing back to Enoch and Elijah. It's not that Enoch and Elijah were any more holy than other holy people like John the Baptist, for example. I think there are other people probably were as equally sanctified as they were, but in the scheme of things, God determined that he was going to simply translate Enoch and just take Elijah up in a chariot.
And since he doesn't really tell us about his purposes must be something that was unique to himself, he's not telling that it wasn't important for us to know,
so
we'll find out.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay. We have one more minute, which sort of segues not so neatly into something I've also wondered about in the Transfiguration,
mm-hmm.
when Jesus is on the mountain, he's talking to Moses and Elijah. And they seem to be pretty physical. Peter wanted to put his hand up for them, but Jesus had not yet arisen, you know, all so what was there that had the label Moses and Elijah?
I don't know. I don't know. Sorry. Okay, I need to let you go.